The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening. And two weeks ago I gave a talk on the first of the Four Noble Truths, and that led to last week giving a talk on the second of the Four Noble Truths. So the logical thing would be to tonight give a talk on the Third Noble Truth. So that's what I'd like to do. It's the Four Noble Truths are at the heart of Buddhism, and many years ago I was just beginning to get interested in Buddhism. Or I've been interested for a little while, but I was maybe 20, I forget, about 23 years old or something, and I'd been practicing for a little while, and I was living in San Francisco. I had to be near the San Francisco Zen Center, so I'd gotten pretty serious about practicing. I went to visit, have dinner with an old girlfriend. And in the course of the dinner, she asked me, you know, what was this Buddhism thing you're doing? So I said something about the Four Noble Truths. And as I was leaving her house, I was walking through the streets of San Francisco, and I kind of thought, boy, you know, this great world religion, and all I could say was something about the Four Noble Truths, as if it was like really simple children stuff. But what I've come to appreciate is that even though the Four Noble Truths can be formulated very easily, and so maybe a child could understand them, they are extremely profound truths that the profundity isn't obvious at first. It isn't obvious until you start practicing with them how thoroughgoing and penetrating they are in a person's life, how they address so many different issues. The first of the Noble Truths is the truth of suffering. And the task with the truth of suffering, the Buddhist practice around suffering, is to understand it well. And this is counterintuitive for many people. Their intuition tells them, avoid your suffering. Turn away from it, run away from it, change it, get rid of it. But the idea of turning towards it to understand it more deeply is that sometimes takes some doing before we're ready for that or understand the value of that. There's an analogy of the usefulness of studying suffering, being present for suffering, which is the analogy is that if you go to the savannas, the plains of Africa, to be a nature photographer, take pictures of all the animals there. If you want to get a picture of all the animals, you'd be running around all day, you know, all over the place trying to find them all, exhaust yourself. But if you set up a camera near the watering hole, eventually all the animals will come to you, and because they all have to drink. So for Buddhists, suffering is your watering hole. And because all the issues, all the important issues in your life, all the important personal issues, psychological issues, religious issues, philosophical issues, existential issues, social issues, they'll all kind of become clear at the watering hole of suffering. And that's very significant because sometimes if you don't have a good grounding, a good foundation, a kind of practical grounding for looking at all these kinds of questions, it gets very abstract very quickly. And in a religious world, it gets metaphysical, supernatural very quickly. But if you have a watering hole where, you know, you can just sit there and just really kind of really see them for what they are, you don't have to look for imaginary animals. You see the real ones that come. You know exactly what to address. So that's the first task. The second task of the Four Noble Truths is the second noble truth, which is to abandon or the cause of that suffering. And the cause is found in clinging, or grasping, or thirsting. And so that's to be let go of. The third noble truth, the topic of today, is the truth of cessation, cessation here, meaning specifically meaning the ending of suffering and the ending of the grasping that gives birth to that suffering. So the second is to let go, the task is to let go, and the third is to realize that cessation, that ending. So some of you know that a classic image of a out-of-control mind is that of the monkey mind. Supposedly a monkey will swing from tree to tree, from branch to branch, and as soon as it lets go of one branch, it's reaching out to grab the next. And as soon as it lets go of one, it reaches out to grab the next. So the monkey mind is a mind like that, where we're constantly swinging from one thing to cling to the next. And there's no end to clinging. So we somehow or other, we let go of one thing, and the mind is already looking forward to the next thing to cling. I remember when my son was, I don't know how old he was, but very young. Maybe he was like a year and a half or so. Remember, I think my wife was holding him. And he had no idea what was behind him. But he reached out his hand behind his back, kind of, to grab it anyway. He didn't know what he was trying to grasp, what he was clinging to, what he wanted. He just knew he wanted. So I don't know how many of you are that way, that whether sometimes the momentum of grasping, of wanting, there's this momentum in there. It doesn't really matter what you want. You're just going to reach out for the next thing, next thing. So the monkey mind is that way, you can see in your mind, because we reach out for one kind of thought, we let go of it, and we pick up the next one. Or we exhaust one train of thinking, and the mind immediately picks up the next, if it's lucky enough. And it goes on and on and on. We're grabbing, grabbing. So I say this because the other side of always grabbing is always letting go. Monkeys are constantly letting go as well, but they let go only to grab again. In our ordinary life, I think that all human beings are let go a lot. It happens pretty often, pretty much. In some ways, we're all experts at letting go. Not when we want to, but it happens a lot. In a few minutes, you all let go of IMC, and you'll walk out the door, and that'll be it for the evening. The monkey mind is let go, but then grabs the next thing. And so, it's one thing to let go of clinging, and to it's another thing to stay or rest in that place of cessation. It's another thing to let go and then stay having let go, not to pick up again. And even sometimes very profound forms of letting go, we let go of, the mind is so quick to go on to the next thing, something else. There's something very significant about realizing or appreciating or hanging in there, hanging out with that place of peace, of rest, of stilling, of feeling the value of having let go and released. So, another analogy that I like, I used it here a few weeks ago. We might cling to our fist. We might make a fist. And a fist has some usefulness, but it limits dramatically what we can do with our hand. And the soft, tender, sensitive part of our hand disappears inside the fist. If we can release the fist, there's much more you can do with a hand. You can do things with your fingers and your thumbs, and you can also feel and sense things in a nice way with your fingers. The hand is much more useful open than it is closed. So it's very important then to learn how to let go. But now, if you open your fist, that's nice, but then immediately tighten and close up again, then you won't learn to appreciate or value what's possible when the hand is open. So the fist in the mind is the same way. We cling, hold on to all kinds of things. We hold on to the impression we want to make on other people. And there's a lot of jockeying. A lot of people choose their words, choose their clothes, choose who they spend time with, what all kinds of things they choose in order to make a right impression. Impression to their friends, impression to their colleagues, impression to their family, many things. So people cling to that. People cling to their opinions. They cling to wanting to be right. And so some people hold it on very, very tenacious. Some people are very stubborn about it. People cling to their pleasures, their comforts, their security. So at some point, it's possible to let go of that. And if we can stay letting go and not grasp another thing again, reach out and grab the next thing, and then we might be able to feel or experience or discover the greater dexterity, flexibility, sensitivity that still, peaceful mind has. Some of the most beautiful qualities of the mind or of the heart can only arise when clinging has been stilled, when it's quieted down, when it's come to an end. And so, but for some people that's counterintuitive, because all they know is clinging and holding on and having and getting or resisting. And sometimes it can feel very frightening to not be constantly involved in a life of making things up, holding things, getting things, wanting things, resisting things. And so there's a kind of, people don't take the time to hang out in that space of peace, of letting go, of stillness. There's all these words of emptiness, of freedom, of awakefulness, of liberation. But if you hang in there long enough, then you start, after a while you start feeling there's a lot going on there. There's these beautiful qualities of the heart. There's kind of a very kind of refreshing kind of joy, happiness. There's love, there's compassion. There's a deeper, different kind of way of understanding ourselves, other people, the world around us. It's a beautiful place to reside. So here we're talking about realizing cessation. The way it's worded sounds like nothing there, right? Just cessation. Cessation sounds pretty grim. But it's talking about the cessation of clinging, the cessation of suffering, not cessation of everything. What's left for you when you're not clinging, when you're not suffering? Hopefully the world is really rich and wonderful. It has, you know, you are really a wonderful person, rich person, multidimensional person. So there's much, a lot of you left when you've ceased suffering. Wouldn't that be nice? Let's hope. So the second noble truth is to abandon or let go of clinging. Now, one of the what's very important to also appreciate here is that letting go does not mean the same thing as getting rid of. It doesn't mean the same thing as throwing away. It doesn't mean the same thing as dismissing something. Because to get rid of, to dismiss, to throw away is, in Buddhism, is the way we see it, is a form of aversion. And aversion, if you let go of something out of aversion, out of hostility, out of dislike, you're strengthening the habit or the tendency of the mind to be aversive. If you're aversive to clinging, aversive to suffering, and throw it away, reject it, if that's how you let go of things, is by rejecting it, then you haven't really rejected clinging. You'd rather strengthen it. So the movement of letting go, the trick or the aspect of it is how do we let go without any sense of rejection or aversion, hostility towards what it is we're letting go of. There has to be wisdom to know that, oh, this is useful to let go of. But how to do it in a way where, and it's, I don't know what to say, we're at peace with it, or you know, we're generous towards it, or there's no rejection to it. There's no hostility towards it. I think it's a very, very important quality, aspect of it. So to learn to let go, and then to learn cessation, to realize cessation, to understand cessation. One of the reasons, I believe, that the Buddhist tradition talks about the goal in the terms of the absence of something, a negative quality of cessation, is that people have such a strong tendency to want their religious life to lead to something positive. And you get all these kinds of images, ideals, ideas of what you're supposed to get, who you're supposed to be. And when you have a positive image of where you're going, it's very easy to get attached to it. And so it stands in the way of being able to let go completely. So I think there's some wisdom to having the ultimate goal be an absence of clinging, and letting the what follows as a result stand for itself. You don't have to name it, you don't even understand it that well. You don't have to kind of reify it. But then you can live a free life. To trust that life that flows through you. Maybe it can't be a thing. Maybe it can't be pointed to or described, but it can be lived, and it's discovered in the very living. So I know in the Zen tradition that I trained in, if you ask a Zen teacher, good Zen practitioner, who are you? If there's not a good Zen practitioner and they give you an answer, I am, then the teacher hits them over the head or throws them out or something. But usually the best answers are not, especially if you say I am, and then you say a noun, like I am Gil, or I am a teacher, or I am a father, or I am, out you go. The right answer, more often than not, has to do with not even something you say, but something you do. So, you're sitting, at the kitchen table with your Zen master, and Zen master asks her, who are you? So you get up and you offer tea. May I offer you some tea? And that's the answer. Or if you're out sweeping the temple grounds, monastery grounds, and someone walks up to you while you're sweeping and say, who are you? And you don't get an answer. Seemingly don't get an answer because the nun just keeps sweeping. didn't she hear me? I said, who are you? She sweeps some more. The sweeping is the answer. And so it's very situational. In the particular situation, you are your activity. You're not separate. That's what defines you as the activity of the moment. And you only discover who you are in the activity. If you say, I'm a sweeper, and then, you go do something else, you could become go work in the kitchen washing pots. Someone shows up in the kitchen and says, who are you? And you say, I'm a sweeper. I'm the sweeper. No. Right then you're the pot washer. You're pot washing. Not even pot washer. You're pot washing. That's what you are. So that makes some sense? So the idea of not reifying who you are or anything. And so by realizing cessation, you allow this life flow or life activity to flow through us freely without defining what it is. So, meditation practice is one of the great places to experience cessation. And I think most people, everyone I think who has some experience in meditation, has some experience with a cessation of some things. Maybe not cessation in the capital C, but a lot of small cessations. And I hope that some of you, in the course of the 45 minutes of meditation we had, something relaxed, settled, was let go of in the course of the 45 minutes. When you came in, maybe you were agitated about something, concerned about something from the day, the mind was spinning. And something kind of settled away. You didn't spend 45 minutes having the same train of thought and just kind of churning away about the same thing. But hopefully things softened, relaxed, lessened, and something ceased. Maybe, if nothing else, maybe the intensity of a certain preoccupation. Maybe something fell away entirely. Some things, maybe not everything fell away. Maybe you're still involved with some kind of thought or concern, but something ceased. You became calmer, more settled. So the task is to appreciate not only being mindful of what is, but appreciate what it feels like, what the experience is like to have that which is, has ceased to have ceased. To take that in and let it register. So you, in a sense, we can learn from it or be informed by it or be changed by it, be inspired by it, be guided by it, by that experience. Wow, that feels good. Not to be preoccupied anymore by that thing. Not to be angry about that activity anymore. Not to be filled with desire for that thing anymore. That feels really good. It feels like there's more space in my mind. I feel more open. I feel less stressed. That's what it's like. Cessation has those qualities to it. Make sense? So, as I did the last 2 weeks, I thought I would ask you a question. And I've already said some, I've given you some answers, hopefully we can say more. What are some of the things that can be realized when you understand, when you realize cessation? When clinging has ceased, what can be realized in that space of cessation, of that grasping? What's the other side of it that's beneficial? The question make sense? So if we can maybe pass the mic here.
Peace. I just feel peace and comfort.
And so there can be experiences of peace and comfort. Thank you. Can we hear Ursula?
The realization that what I'm clinging to isn't really, that I can't be happy without it. It didn't really make me happy, and letting go of it, I can't be happy like that. Yes. And that.
So you thought it was going to make you happy, so you clung to it. But then you realized when you ceased clinging to it, you didn't actually need it to be
happy. I didn't need it. That's a lot of freedom, I think.
And a lot of freedom with that. Beautiful. Thank you. I wonder how many people cling to things that they don't really need. I guess that was the leading question. So we see the green button.
When I let go of cessation, then I can connect to my true intention and what it is that I'm really trying to bring to the situation at hand, and I can my words match up with what I really had wanted or intended. And also I realize that I had an expectation usually if I'm feeling frustrated or suffering in a situation, so I realize I was responsible for thinking the situation should be different than it really is.
Great. So it's hard to know our true intention if we're clinging. Right behind you.
I think that so often what I'm clinging to is what doesn't exist at all. It's in the past. It's in the future. It's kind of my virtual reality that's in my head. And so in the brief moments where I feel there's some sort of cessation of those types of thoughts, it's when I realize, oh, there's this reality here in this moment. And for me, it's brief, but it is, like you said, a moment of peace.
Nice. So that's profound what you said. It's possible that, if you're at the edge of Half Dome and holding on to the railing, then you're clinging to something real. But aside from those kinds of circumstances, most clinging that people do, most psychological clinging, all psychological clinging, is a kind of clinging to a virtual reality. It's to ideas. And we think it's real, but it's really something that we believe in our head. And it's, you know, it's a virtual reality. And so if you let go, maybe we can contact reality, life, more closely as it actually is. Here in the front.
One of the things that I cling to would be, say, if I decide I want you to like me. And so then in every interaction, I'm somehow trying to manipulate it to create connection. And what happens when I actually let go of trying to do that manipulation and can just be present, then that connection happens. But it's sort of like only by letting go of wanting it that it can actually arise.
So when we stop clinging to a relationship, perhaps it allows some deeper, a more natural, perhaps a more kind of process of connection to happen. Thank you.
Sometimes I feel the power of observation begins when I stop thinking about certain things, and I find that I've been passing things by that I could really look at and see the beauty in it, or just the way it is. Where, you know, sometimes when I'm clinging to all the ideas about what it could be or what it does for me or how I react to it, I don't see it clearly. So it kind of makes me feel as though I want to stop and notice things more.
Beautiful. So cessation of clinging can allow clearer seeing.
For me, it seems like clinging is like one possibility. It's like it's finite, one thing. Whereas if I don't cling, there's infinite possibilities in the situation, or much more, much less finite.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Am I on?
Yeah.
It sounds good. My experience is normally I tend to go to aversion quite easily, and I say that I'm letting go when in fact I'm being quite aversive. So for me, my experience has been it's only been through real pain and suffering that when I finally let go of the thing, and I don't. It's not like I chose to sit there and be like, I'm just going to let go of this, because I've tried and I'll either pick up another object or I'll go back to that object. And it's when I fully have exhausted it and I sit there, then cessation happens. So, and I think what I found for myself was that there was this I, there was this identity, there was this, what I was left with me. I was left with me. I wasn't left with the thing that created the suffering. The thing is just a thing. The tree is just a tree. The car is just a car. The light is just a light. I was left with me and how I interact with these things, and that really I was one of these things. And there are moments where I'm very clear on that. There are other moments where I'm not so clear on that. And I come in and out of that.
Beautiful. Thank you. You know, letting go is some things are easy to let go of, and some things are really hard to let go of. And I remember there was a period of on retreats for me where I had all this anger, and I tried everything I could to get rid of the anger. And, and I suppose there was aversion to the anger as part of letting go, rejecting it, you know, judgments. I only was able to let go of it when I gave up all attempts at trying to get rid of it. I give up. and that's when it let up. In the back.
I sense this tremendous tendency, I think you mentioned it, to have an agenda to let go, because we know it's the right thing, or I know it's the right thing to do, and I want to do the right thing because I want my practice to be the right thing, and I want to come to clarity and lack of suffering, so I want to do the right thing, and that's a really hard one. And maybe, like some people are saying, it only can happen when the suffering is enough, and maybe somebody says something like, you know, it doesn't get really expansive and open and full of possibilities until I let go of that, and the possibilities become more attractive than what I've been clinging to.
It reminds me of some of the early... again, Zen practice sesshins, long intense Zen retreats that I would sit. And I used to sit with a lot of pain. And I had two little tricks in my mind, the thought tricks that would help me sit with the intense pain. Because in Zen, you're not supposed to move. So once you're in pain, you have to wait for the bell. And there was a lot of waiting for the bell meditation. And hit that bell, you know. But the two little things that helped was thought kind of things I would tell myself. I have usually like a mantra over and over again. One mantra was just this moment. Let me get through this moment. This moment only. Just this moment. And but the other one what if this is forever? What if this pain is forever? What if this sitting is forever? And that would actually help, because then there was nowhere else to go. Just like, you know, just, okay, here I am, this is it. And that would create some space, some space and some peace around the intensity of what I was experiencing. Yes, we have that.
It's more of a question, actually. It's along the same lines of what I heard some, is that distinction between when am I manipulating and aversion, or, you know, telling myself stories about it versus really letting go of it. And often also, even if I had let go, it comes back at different times, maybe. I mean, it's never 100% let go either.
Mm. Well, that's interesting, you know, not 100%. This is kind of taking off from what you said, and also what Abram said, is Abram wants to be the perfect practitioner, do it just right. And sometimes it's better in Buddhist practice I don't know what the percentage is right, but to do it about, you know, 70% right. And because if you do it 70% right, sometimes it actually goes faster. The practice, you develop quicker. If you try to do it 100% right, you just kind of tie yourself in knots and get all worked up and get, you know, kind of uptight and kind of irritating for everybody else. And so sometimes it actually works faster if you don't try too hard to be the best one.
I found that you've talked about the pain, and I found that sometimes if I have a pain when I'm meditating, and I probably don't know what a number 10 or 9 pain is. I mean, I think some people have had that kind of pain, but this would have been one of the lesser ones. But I found if I go into the pain, absolutely look at it, experience it, really encounter it, and it's hard sometimes because you tend to withdraw, but then to go back into it again, very often it would dissipate.
Yes, for many reasons it does that. But one of the interesting reasons in relationship to the talk tonight is that paradoxically, or ironically, some of the physical and also some of the physical and some of the psychological pain that we can experience is not the thing itself, but our resistance to it. And so once we kind of go into it directly and go through the resistance, let go of the resistance, sometimes the very pain itself can dissipate.
Do we have
quite true of physical pain, because you do tighten up, and that probably exacerbates it.
Yeah. So, I'm ready to let go of the evening. Is that enough? So, the first noble truth is to be understood. The second noble truth is to be abandoned. The third noble truth of cessation is to be realized. May you all realize cessation. And for this week, I would ask you, suggest to you, that you look for the ordinary moments of cessation through your day. I'm sure you all experience where you let go of something, some concern, something, you know. It could be as simple as, you know, I think an example I gave last week was, you know, you're driving along and you see that up ahead the light is green, but can you really make it before it turns red? And so there's, you know, you feel yourself tightening up ever so slightly, and, you know, mind begin to race ever so slightly, but can I make it, you know, and are there police cars around? And you know, let's just let go of it. Who cares? Let's just relax. And let's, you know, not speed up, and if it turns yellow, let me slow down and stop properly. That's a moment of cessation. You seized the attachment to, you know, rushing through the traffic light. Maybe there's much more dramatic ones you can experience this week, but look for those experiences of cessation that you have throughout the day, and pause for them. Learn from them, appreciate them. See if you can be a student of those times, and see what you can learn that you wouldn't learn if you let go of something, see something, and just went on to the next thing quickly. So, thank you very much.